Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's rise to greatness, the first British and American Empire, 1000 BC, when we come back. You know, Charles Lyell is one of the pillars of modern geology, and he published his Principles of Geology back in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most people who believe them don't even know who it was that originated those ideas. But it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins has been devised. They devised it by simply projecting all of the natural processes and forces that we observe today back through time indefinitely. And in that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood have been strictly ruled out, and this process is called science. Well, listen to this. Niagara Falls. This famous waterfall is a magnificent example of a geologic clock, and it reveals that the Earth is very young. It reveals the young age of the Earth because the rim of the falls is wearing back at a known rate every year, and it can be measured precisely. And geologists recognize that it has only taken 5,000 years or less to erode from its original precipice. Now, what did our teachers tell us about the extinction of the dinosaurs? Do you remember that was about 65 million years ago, they told us? And yet when we measure the erosion of Niagara Falls, it's less than 5,000 years. Now, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do the math on these kinds of pseudo-scientific lies. And it's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda masquerading under the label science. And that's one more of the many lessons that I teach in my Mosaic Law School. For more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right now. That number to call, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, as the second millennium BC drew to a close, the geopolitics of that time involved nations and empires in what we now call the Middle East, or the Fertile Crescent. On the eastern arc of the Fertile Crescent, in the area of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, were the established Mesopotamian powers of Assyria and Babylon. On the western arc of the Fertile Crescent were Egypt, Israel, Tyre, and Sidon. So let us first examine the geopolitical situation from the perspective of these nations as the first millennium BC was drawing to a close. At that time, the eastern Mediterranean coast was home to several distinct groups of people. Tyre and Sidon were the chief representatives of mercantile maritime city-states known to modern man as the Phoenicians. The term Phoenicia has been widely misunderstood, but there will be more on that subject as we proceed. Further south on the coast were the Philistines. The Philistines were centered around their city-states of Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. And additionally, the Israelites were spread throughout the region known to us today as the land of the modern Israelis, southern Lebanon, and western Jordan. The Israelites were composed of 12 tribal units that had only recently been brought under the jurisdiction of a single monarch. That monarch was David. Now, their first monarch, King Saul, had been defeated and killed in battle by the Philistines. David, his replacement, the banished son-in-law of King Saul, became king over the Israelite tribe of Judah, while the house of Saul continued to rule over the remaining Israelite tribes for several more years. Finally, David became king over all of the tribes of Israel, as we read in 2 Samuel 5, verses 1 through 5. And David was a classic warrior king, and he quickly integrated the fighting men of his unified kingdom into one single powerful military force. And the year was approximately 1000 BC. Now, King David of Israel aggressively expanded Israel's borders and influence. His territory of direct rule soon reached from the border of Egypt to the Euphrates River, as we see in 1 Chronicles 18, verse 3. King David's campaign to expand Israel's borders was an exceedingly bloody one, and the Bible records that David's army slaughtered many thousands in the process of conquering the Philistines, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, and the Syrians, at that time known as the Arameans. Now, according to 2 Samuel 8, verse 2, he lined up the defeated Moabites, most likely the adult males, and he executed two-thirds of them, leaving only one-third of them alive. And in a series of battles with Syrian kings, almost 80,000 Syrians died, as we read in 2 Samuel 8, verses 3 through 13, and 2 Samuel 10, verses 16 through 19. While David was punished by God for numbering Israel's military manpower, such an act was a step toward relying on man's might rather than God's, the Bible nevertheless recorded the size of Israel's army for our information today. With the tribes of Levi and Benjamin unaccounted, David commanded an army of 1,570,000 soldiers. That's reported in 1 Chronicles 21, verses 1 through 17. How much of David's army consisted of standing army contingents, and what portion was essentially a trained, ready reserve, we do not know. For comparison purposes, however, an army of that size, 1.5 million men, would compare with the great armies of the major nations of the modern world today. And this total should not be understood to imply that ancient Israel's population rivaled that of a modern large nation, but it does reflect the military manpower available in a different age when almost all adult males were trained in military art and available for mobilization. There is an important historical fact in the Bible's discussion of this military census, as we see in 1 Chronicles 21, verse 5, where it tells us that Joab gave the sum of the number of the people unto David, and all they of Israel were 1,000,000. And 100,000 men that drew the sword, and Judah was 430,000 men that drew the sword. Now, after the death of King Saul, David became king over Judah while a rival ruled the kingdom of Israel, as we see in 2 Samuel 2, verses 3 through 10. After a period of 7.5 years in which the two Hebrew kingdoms were periodically at war with each other, reported in 2 Samuel 2, verses 13 through 31, and 2 Samuel 3, verse 1, they were finally united under King David in 2 Samuel 5, verses 1 through 5. The above military census shows that even under King David, Israel and Judah constituted separate entities, temporarily ruled by the same king, since their armies were still totaled as separate units within the overall military establishment, and it indicates that the amalgamation of Israel, the northern 10 tribes, and Judah, the southern tribe, with contingents of the other tribes was a tenuous one. Israel, with more tribes to count, had 1,100,000 soldiers available for combat, and Judah had 470,000 soldiers. Now, the Bible contains more than one census of the relative military strengths of Israel and Judah. The McClintock and Strong Cyclopedia offers estimates about the populations of Israel and Judah based upon the military forces available to each of them. While acknowledging that the calculations are inexact, these encyclopedias tell us, quote, according to the general laws observable in such cases, these numbers may be said to represent an aggregate population of from 5.5 to 6 million people, of which about one-third, or 2 million, may be fairly assigned to the kingdom of Judah at the time of the separation. Now, if Judah had a population of 2 million and Israel had 4 million people, then the two kingdoms went their separate ways. It means that King David, who ruled over them jointly, governed a nation of approximately 6 million people. When the nation was fully mobilized, he could command an army of over 1.5 million men. Now, by any standard, this was a very potent military force in the ancient world, and David's willingness, indeed eagerness, to use this vast military resource to accomplish his ends struck fear into the other nations of that time. And as we shall soon see, David's expansionism was soon challenged by the established Mesopotamian powers of Assyria and Babylon. Now, while David had his share of human faults, he did have an attitude of submission and worship toward the Creator, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the book of Psalms testifies of his worship and his attitude, which resulted in God's favor on David's actions. In discussing David's conquests in 1 Chronicles 18, verse 6, the Bible tells us, "Thus the Eternal preserved David, whithersoever he went." Now, while David was a very skilled warrior and leader, the greatness of his kingdom was a result of God's favor on his actions, as David himself realized and reported in 2 Samuel 7, verses 18 through 29. Now, Israel, Tyre, and Sidon form an alliance called the Phoenician Alliance. And at this juncture of the story, we need to examine the historical context of that time to understand the reaction of the Phoenician city-states located immediately to the north of Israel. Now, the Phoenician city-states, principally Tyre and Sidon, were in control of a far-flung trading and commercial empire held together by an extensive merchant fleet and navy.
The products from distant seaports flowed into their city-states, which acted as focal points between maritime and overland trade routes. Now, the famous British historian George Rawlinson confirmed that the Phoenicians established a network of maritime trading colonies throughout the region of the Mediterranean Sea and the western shores of Europe and of North Africa and of West Africa and the British Isles. Many historical writers confirm this, and the exported Phoenician artifacts that have been discovered in these regions prove it. However, the Phoenicians had very little hinterland to support the population of their city-states, and consequently they needed to import foodstuffs. And Rawlinson asserts that Phoenicia's main trading partner for food, or its breadbasket, was the area inhabited by the Israelites. And the Bible also confirms that Israel's primary trading commodity with Phoenicia was in fact foodstuffs, as we see in Ezekiel 27, verse 17. Now, the city-states of Tyre and Sidon had other reasons to look favorably upon King David's expansionism. When King David subjugated the Philistines and Syrians, he eliminated some of Tyre and Sidon's commercial competitors. The merchants of Tyre and Sidon saw David's expansionism and an alliance with Israel as a means to establish a commercial and trading monopoly of their own. And one author has noted the following. It said, "The great Syrian campaign of David reduced Damascus, the terminus of the great overland trade routes through Western Asia and Southern and Eastern Arabia, to the position of a Hebrew dependency or colony. But the association with Israel resulted in an even more important advantage to Phoenicia. In this campaign against the Edomites, east and north of the Red Sea, King David raised the embargo placed on the navigation of the Red Sea toward its own Phoenician ports." Now, the leaders of Tyre and Sidon saw an alliance between their city-states and King David's Israelites as a means toward creating a worldwide commercial trading monopoly. And King David's army not only diminished Tyre and Sidon's competitors, but Israel's army could guard the land routes coming from Asia to Tyre and Sidon. Israel's capture of the Red Sea ports offered maritime access to the trade goods of Asia and India. This route would be safer and quicker than transporting goods overland by way of risky caravans, and in turn, an alliance with Tyre and Sidon offered the Israelites a full partnership in this prospective global trading monopoly. And author Thomas Johnston, in his book on the Phoenicians, states, quote, "The Phoenicians, while under the protection of Israel, were never called on to pay tribute. Now, these proposals could not fail to be of great advantage to both parties." And it also illustrates two important points about the Phoenician-Israelite alliance. And that is, first, Israel was the stronger power which protected Phoenicia. And two, the alliance was considered a partnership of equals because Phoenicia did not pay tribute to Israel. Phoenicia's equality in the alliance recognized the superior maritime skills that they brought into the alliance. The respected archaeologist and historian Cyrus Gordon wrote the following about this alliance. He said, quote, "This pact enabled Israel to profit from Phoenician shipbuilding and navigational experience. Hiram, the king of Tyre, benefited from Israel's control of the land routes, including caravan cities, and of access to the Red Sea by way of the key port of Ezion Geber, and it is clear that the Phoenicians had prior mercantile interests in the Indian Ocean by way of the Red Sea." In addition to a lucrative trading relationship, two other factors worked toward a natural affinity between Phoenicia and Israel. These factors were a common language and shared racial origins. Language specialists have long known that Phoenicia and Israel possessed closely related Semitic languages, and they are both classified as being in the Canaanite branch of the Northwest Semitic family of languages. To illustrate to all of you, the readers, how similar these languages were, we cite the comments of the 19th century British historian George Rawlinson again, who tells us, quote, "The words most commonly in use, the particles, the pronouns, the forms of the verbs, the principal inflections, and we may add the numerals in Phoenician are identical or nearly identical with pure Hebrew." Now, the Bible confirms the close relationship between these two languages by recording that the Israelite prophet Elijah had no difficulty communicating with a widow who sheltered him in a Sidonian suburb, as we read in 1 Kings 17, verses 9 through 16. The alphabets of these two languages were strikingly similar as well, and Rawlinson continues regarding the similarities between Hebrew and Phoenician, as he tells us. "The Phoenicians spoke a Semitic tongue, very closely allied to the Hebrew. Among the ancients, Jerome, Augustine, and Priscian state the fact that in the clearest terms, these languages were virtually the same. and the inscriptions which exist confirm it. A good Hebrew scholar today has no difficulty in understanding any legible Phoenician inscription, and as soon as he knows the letters are identical with those which the Hebrews used anciently. Now, this uniform alphabetic system, with slight modifications, appears to have been employed by the Phoenicians, the Jews, the Samaritans, and the Moabites. This alphabet is that which has commonly been called Phoenician, because the Greeks ascribed its invention to the Phoenicians. It is, however, like the Hebrew, an alphabet of 22 letters. Now, while there were dialectical differences, it is clear that Israel and Phoenicia shared a common language, greatly facilitating a mutual joint venture in monopolizing world commerce. The Israelites and the Phoenicians were both Semitic people, and they shared a common racial origin. This fact also contributed to the easy compatibility of both nations. The king of Tyre at that time was named Hiram. With so much in common between his people and the Israelites, and recognizing the tremendous commercial opportunities in this alliance, King Hiram initiated peaceful overtures toward King David, as we see in 2 Samuel 5, verse 11. Hiram sent materials and craftsmen to build David a royal home as a token of his friendship. This gift of an elegant home became the inspiration for David's later desire to build a great temple for God that is recorded in 2 Samuel 7, verses 1 through 3. By initiating the Phoenician-Israelite friendship, Hiram was taking the classic action of a lesser power seeking to build goodwill with a greater power. The Phoenician city-states did not have the resources to challenge Israel on land, and David could easily have cut off many Phoenician trade routes if he became angered. While Hiram's ingratiating action was likely an act of good politics to advance his own commercial position, his actions led to a strong alliance between Israel and Phoenicia. In fact, a close personal friendship developed between Kings David and Hiram, as we see in 1 Kings chapter 5, verse 1. Now, King Hiram was the leader of the Phoenician city-states. So it is logical that his actions bound all of the Phoenician city-states to an alliance with Israel at that time. Any Phoenician city-state that would have opposed the alliance would have been committing military and economic suicide. The Phoenician-Israelite alliance united the world's greatest commercial and naval power with the immense land power of King David's army, making this alliance one of the strongest military powers in the world at that time. Now, an indication of just how powerful this alliance became is in the fact that Assyria's warlike empire was successfully repelled during the time of the United Kingdom of Israel in its alliance with the Phoenician city-states. Other sources show that Assyria entered a period of decline during Israel's rise to power. Collier's Encyclopedia refers to this period of time between 1100 BC and 900 BC as a period of Assyrian confusion between warlike and expansionary phases. This time period coincides with the reigns of Kings David and Solomon over the United Tribes of Israel and their vassal city-states. Halley's Bible Handbook notes Israel's supremacy at that time and the relative weakness of Assyria, Babylon, and Egypt. Dr. Cyrus Gordon also comments on Israel's dominance in the time of King David as he writes, quote, Mesopotamia, Anatolia, Egypt, and the Aegean lacked the strength to take over or control the area. This provided ancient Israel with its opportunity to win a place in the sun, and King David emerged and carried on the struggle about 1000 BC. A succession of victories carved out an empire from the borders of Egypt to the Euphrates River. Now, it must be remembered that David's 1.5 million-man army was not the only military force at his disposal. Phoenicia's navy was allied to him, and the vassal states of Syria, Edom, Moab, and Ammon also. They could be called upon to commit their armies in service to David, although their forces likely had suspect loyalties. Now, Israel totally defeated the Assyrians and became a world-ruling empire about 1000 to 900 B.C., and Assyria's quiescence during this time was because that it had challenged and then had been defeated by King David's Israelite forces. And while the statement may surprise some people, there is ample biblical and secular evidence to support such a conclusion. Indeed, the Bible gives an account of a major armed conflict between King David's Israel and the Mesopotamian powers of Assyria and Babylon, in which the Mesopotamian powers were soundly defeated. And the Bible states in 1 Chronicles 19, verses 1 through 7, that the Ammonites, a subject people of Israel, provoked a war with King David, and they hired a huge number of soldiers from Mesopotamian nations and Syria to fight King David's army. Now, this biblical passage states that the Ammonites hired 32,000 chariots, the number of soldiers is unspecified, for this war against King David's Israelite army. Now, some may find a total of 32,000 chariots hard to believe, as that is an incredible number of chariots in any ancient context. Now, does this represent a total of chariots filled with fighting men, or does it represent a more general description of all of the horse-drawn vehicles that were transporting soldiers? This author recognizes that there is room for honest disagreement about the original writer of Chronicles and what he meant by the word chariot. However, the Israelites faced powerful enemies who could field a very large combined military force. Now, the term Mesopotamia is broad enough to include Assyria, Babylon, and their allied vassal states. Their numbers were further swelled by the armies of the Arameans, the Syrian kings, as we see in 1 Chronicles 19, verses 6 and 7. Now, we will soon examine the likelihood that Psalm 83, verses 1 through 8, discusses this very war, listing other nations that joined this alliance against King David. Therefore, it should be realized that the Bible does not require that 32,000 chariots belong to a single national army, but likely indicates that this was the total number of chariots hired out of many nations to oppose King David's army. Now, the Israelites prevailed, and the Mesopotamian armies returned to their home nations, beaten and bloodied. But there is much more here than first meets the eye. Assyria and the other Mesopotamian powers were aware of the meteoric rise of Israel's power and the expansionism, and undoubtedly looked upon King David as a potential rival for preeminence in the ancient world. As established military powers, the Mesopotamians challenged David's power before it grew even stronger. So when David's armies reached the Euphrates River, the Assyrians had to take action. The Ammonites were a weak tributary nation subject to David and were no doubt aware that David had executed two-thirds of the Moabites who had rebelled against him. Now, why would they dare to take such a suicidal action of humiliating David's ambassadors and provoking David into a warlike response? 1 Chronicles 19, verses 1 through 5, tells us that the only logical explanation is that the Ammonites were acting as local agents, the agents provocateur for others who wanted a war with King David. The Ammonites knew that they were backed by powerful outside allies who supported their hostile action. The rest of the account supports that conclusion. In reality, the Ammonites were the vassals of the Assyrians and the Babylonians. Well, let's take a break right here. We got to give you a reminder. The story that you're hearing or listening to is from the book, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, a book written by Stephen M. Collins, another in a long series of books, a total of six that Collins has written or is in the process of writing, which is published by Bible Blessings. If you'd like more information, why don't you go to their website? It's www.BibleBlessings.net. Again, that's Bible Blessings, the publishing house, www.BibleBlessings.net. Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. The zip code is 48068-1778, which is the zip plus 4. Again, that's Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. This is one of a series of books. I have reviewed some of Mr. Collins' other books, such as The Lost Ten Tribes and Parthia. The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel found an unbelievably riveting historical or ancient historical story of the ancient Israelites. And Parthia, by Stephen M. Collins, is the forgotten ancient superpower and its role in biblical history as the counterpoise or the counterbalance to the Roman Empire. All right, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website. The Law Hour and the website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archive. And remember, it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And remember, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, The Law Hour offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to endorse or recommend the Law Hour or Editorial Review. Most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this local radio station. But they should. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, or call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's georgegordon.org on the webpage, or call the Law School Direct, 417-273-4967. All right, tonight's program, Israel's Rise to Greatness, the First British and American Empire, about 1000 B.C. The story comes from the book, The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. If you'd like a copy of the book, it's entitled The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel by Stephen M. Collins. Now, in 1 Chronicles 19, verses 6 through 9, we read that the Ammonites hired a force of 32,000 chariots and an uncounted number of Syrian and Mesopotamian warriors to fight King David's army on their behalf. As a comparison of how vast this force was, King Solomon is listed as having no more than 1,400 chariots during the zenith of his power. We read that story in 1 Kings 10, verses 24 through 26. Now, since Ammon was paying gold and silver as tribute to Israel already, as recorded in 1 Chronicles 18:11, it hardly had the resources to hire virtually the entire national armies of the Mesopotamian nations. Indeed, verse 6 indicates that the Ammonites had no gold left with which to hire mercenaries and could pay only in silver. So apparently the other nations wanted to challenge Israel, and Ammon's revolt was the pretext to arrange such a conflict, such as the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Cuba was hardly in any position to challenge the United States of America, but Cuba, as a proxy of the Soviet Union and China, could do that. That's what we have here. And the Ammonites knew that it was highly dangerous to provoke David's wrath, and they would not have dared to take such an action without strong assurances from the Mesopotamian powers, principally Assyria, that they would support the Ammonites, and that this huge Mesopotamian army would allow itself to be hired without receiving any gold at all indicates that their presence was a national policy of Assyrian Babylon's king. A force of 32,000 chariots could only have been mustered with the approval of the Assyrian Empire and dominant power, or the dominant power of Mesopotamia. Now, the Bible's use of the term Mesopotamia indicates that the invading force was a joint expeditionary force of many Mesopotamian nations, including Assyria and Babylon, and their vassal and vassal states. 1 Chronicles 19, verses 6 and 7 tell us that the Syrian kings also sent troops to join the Mesopotamian armies in fighting King David. And since David had already conquered portions of Syria, the Syrians were eager to join a large alliance to fight King David to get their territory back. This battle, then, was primarily an effort by the king of Assyria to stop the growing power of King David. And he arranged for virtually his entire army, along with the armies of the other Mesopotamian allies and various Syrian kings, to be hired for a pittance by one of David's subject nations, Ammon, in order to arrange a war with King David's Israelites. Now, interestingly, these Mesopotamian nations and Syria had enough respect for King David and Israel that they did not declare war openly, but allowed their national armies to fight as hired mercenaries of the Ammonites. By this artifice, if things went badly, they could go home and say that they were not technically at war with Israel on a national level. However, confirming that these nations actually wanted a war with King David, 1 Chronicles 19:9 tells us that the kings of the Mesopotamians and the Syrians came with their armies to personally watch the battle. So this battle for supremacy of the ancient world was fought in two stages. The initial stage of the battle is described in 1 Chronicles 19, verses 8 through 15. Israel's army met the combined forces of Ammon, Syria, and the Mesopotamian nations, and defeated them in a two-front battle. The fact that Israel had to split its forces and fight in two separate directions indicates that Israel's army was not expecting to fight so large a force and found itself surrounded by a numerically superior army. And Israel's army expected to fight only the upstart Ammonites, not the combined armies of Mesopotamia. This surprised, nevertheless, Israel's army won the battle, and the Mesopotamians apparently retreated to their own land, as they are not mentioned in the second stage of the battle. So David quickly realized that this conflict involved far more than a revolt by the little nation of Ammon. It was actually an attempt to destroy Israel's army and national power and to prevent it from supplanting Assyria as the preeminent nation in the ancient world. David's thoughts on this war are recorded in Psalm 83, and David's psalms were frequently inspired by events in his life, and the context of this psalm directly parallels the events of 1 Chronicles 19. Psalm 83, verses 3 and 4 refers to a crafty council of many nations, which were assembled to destroy the Israelite nation. Psalm 83:8 tells us that these nations had conspired to help the children of Lot. Ammon was one of Lot's children, as you can read in Genesis 19, verses 36 through 38. And in 1 Chronicles 19, it tells us that an alliance of many nations was fighting Israel under the guise of assisting the Ammonites. Remember, the Ammonites were Lot's children, and this strongly links Psalm 83 and 1 Chronicles 19 as describing the same event. Further, linking these two biblical accounts together, Psalm 83, verse 8 tells us that Assyria also had joined them. This parallels the reference to Mesopotamians in 1 Chronicles 19, as Assyria was the dominant Mesopotamian nation at that time. Now, a number of nations referred to in Psalm 83 were, like Ammon, subject people of Israel who were likely eager to throw off Israel's domination. The Philistines, the Edomites, Moab, and Amalek were all subject to King David of Israel. You'll see that in 1 Chronicles 18, verse 11. And they joined Ammon's revolt against King David. Psalm 83, verse 7 also lists Gebal and inhabitants of Tyre, both Phoenician cities, as being part of the enemy alliance. This indicates that the conspiracy against Israel included some of the Phoenicians, who likely thought that they were siding with a winner by opposing Israel and backing Assyria. Now, King Hiram of Tyre, David's ally, apparently experienced a rebellion of Assyrian sympathizers among his own people. However, the wording of verse 7, inhabitants of Tyre, indicates that while Tyre had Assyrian sympathizers, King Hiram and the city-state itself remained loyal to David. Sidon, another major Phoenician city, apparently stayed loyal to David, as they are not included in the list of Israel's enemies that we read of in Psalm 83. And since King Hiram remained a close friend of David and Israel after this battle, it is obvious that the leadership of Tyre remained loyal to King David, had it been any other. After the battle, these kings would have been killed. Now, while 1 Chronicles utilizes the term Mesopotamians to describe David's foes, David's own account in Psalm 83 is more specific in naming the Assyrians as one of his military opponents. And while the King James Version of the Bible uses the term Asher, in Psalm 83, verse 8, many versions of the Bible translate this word as Assyria. The Revised Standard Version is especially clear in stating Assyria also joined them. And they are the strong arm of the children of Lot, given the fact that Assyria was the leader of the Mesopotamian nations, and that the Ammonites were the children of Lot. There can be little doubt that 1 Chronicles 19 and Psalm 83 are referring to the same war. Now, in the second stage of the battle recorded in 1 Chronicles 19, verse 16, the Israelites and the Syrians mobilized their entire national military resources and clashed again. This time, there was no more pretense that the Syrians were Ammonite mercenaries. In addition, the Assyrians were apparently no longer engaged but had retreated after being defeated by the Israelite army. This account states that David gathered all of Israel and Syria and drew forth the Syrians that were beyond the river, meaning reinforcements from east of the Euphrates River. The second battle of this war involved King David and his fully mobilized army marching eastward from the Jordan River to fight everyone that the Syrians could muster. After suffering 47,000 dead, including their commander, the Syrians yielded to King David and became his servants, meaning that they became vassal nations of Israel and paid tribute to King David. Now, to put the intensity of this battle into perspective for modern readers, the Syrians did not yield until they had lost 47,000 soldiers in one battle. Now, this serves as an indicator to modern readers of how violent and how intense ancient wars could be. And it also indicates that the numbers of men engaged on both sides would easily have been in the hundreds of thousands, as the Syrians hardly fought to the last man. The death of their commander, combined with an awareness that the battle was going against them, as we see in 1 Chronicles 19, verses 17 through 19, caused the Syrians to surrender. Now, another thought, let me make an editorial comment here. During World War I, there were four major battles fought in which the English lost 40,000-plus soldiers killed in a single day. World War I, which fielded armies in the millions of men, fought four battles during World War I in which 40,000 or more soldiers were killed in a single day. In Great Britain, during World War I, had a population of around 60 million people. Now, are you catching the drift here? Take a look at a world map and take a look at the border of Egypt. The border of Egypt. The Bible describes the border of Egypt from the Great River to the Euphrates River. Now, look at the Nile River and then look at that piece of real estate from the Nile River to the Euphrates River. Pretty good sized piece of real estate. It includes Iraq, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and the Sinai Peninsula. It could even have included the peninsula of Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And notice here that David drew reinforcements from east of the Euphrates River, which then takes us into Iran. And there are reports that David's empire extended clear to India. King David and Solomon controlled a world, far-flung world ruling empire that had outposts and colonies in Spain, North Africa, Britain, Europe, South America, Central America, Mexico, the United States, and in the United States, artifacts are found from the Hebrews, from David's period of time in New Hampshire, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Colorado, Michigan, and New Mexico that we know of. And those reports are found in two books, one called America BC by Barry Fell, and the second is called In Plain Sight, written by Gloria Farley. Now, going on, and remember, this is the book written by Stephen Collins. Now, Collins is a historian, a member of the Epigraphic Society, which is centered, I believe, in New Hampshire. He's got qualifications out the wazoo. I'm not going to sit here and brag on you and tell you about all of his qualifications here as a historian. But he ranks up there along with people like Barry Fell and Gloria Farley when we talk about ancient history. I'm not talking about, you know, Columbus discovered America. I mean, if you believe that kind of nonsense, why, you got to turn this radio off. Long before Columbus, there were Europeans here in North America. Not only were they in North America, they were in South and Central America. But in addition to that, we now can put these stories together, that is, In Plain Sight, America BC, and Israel's Lost Empires by Stephen Collins, and put this story together and tell the whole story from the Bible and secular history. And what a story it tells. Now, if you'd like a copy of this book, I don't know what the price is off the top of my head. I think it's around 15 or 20 bucks, figure 20 bucks. There's five books at 20 bucks, a $100 bill. And if you'll order these from the author, I talked to the author the other day myself. I'm going to say the other day is actually a couple, 3 months ago. When I ordered these five books, they'd gotten lost or stolen. I got a bunch of books from Collins, and I put them on my shelf, and students, as they come through school here, these books are so fascinating. These are one in 100 books. You will never read another book like these five books from Stephen Collins. There isn't anything out there like it. It's like America, BC, and In Plain Sight. Those are two more of the one in 100 books. There's nothing else like it. You can get the pablum from the universities and the college, or you can get strong meat, and these books are indeed strong meat, on the order of Emmanuel Velikovsky's books. Bible Blessings is the publisher. It's published by Bible Blessings, www.BibleBlessings, that's all one word, just BibleBlessings.net. Or you can write to them and ask them what the prices are. I don't know, because I got these from Collins directly. And it's box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. 48068-1778. That's the zip code. Royal Oak, Michigan is 48068 is the zip code, and then the zip plus 4 is 1778. Now let me give you a little special here. And I'm going to open my box. I didn't ask Collins if I could do this. I guess I can. I like to get books that are autographed. It makes them worth more later on. And if you want to call Collins and tell him that you heard this over the Law Hour editorial review, and ask him to autograph those books. He'll tell you what the price is. I sent him a $100 bill for the five books. That was 20 bucks each. Now, he gave them to me on special. I don't know if he's going to give them to you on the special or not. But he quoted me a price, and I forget exactly what that price was. But here's his phone number. Number 605-361-5069. Let's see if we can inundate him with calls. 605-361-5069. And just ask him if he'd send you a copy or two or three of the books. I recommend all five books for the $100 bill. I think he'll do the same for you. It's what he did for me. Now remember, he has a discount. He gets these books from the publisher. You have to order them from him if you want him to autograph it. Tell him that old George sent you and that you want these books autographed. Now remember, I rate these books as one in 100. You will read 100 books and you will not find a single book out there in the mainstream media that can compare to Collins' book. And if you think you've got one, write and tell me, would you? And then I'll review it and I'll see whether or not you've got a handle on the one in 100. Now, I oftentimes recommend books that are like a one in 20 read. And it was old King Solomon that made an observation. He said, of the writing of books, there is no end. Of the writing of books, there is no end. Hell, I've written several books, and there isn't anything that I've ever written that can compare. It can't even start to come up to the information that are contained in these five books, or any one of them, for that matter. And I write books on law and one thing and another, but I've never written a 1 in 20 book or a 1 in 100 book. The information that I get, I take it out of the standard material. I'm just an echo. This guy isn't an echo. This guy is the foghorn. Remember, the name is Stephen Collins. That phone number again, 605-361-5069. And tell him you want him to autograph the books. Otherwise, if you don't care one way or the other, don't bother him. Just call the publisher. Now, we're reading from The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, King David and Israel's Rise to Greatness. The nation of Israel in ancient times was so fast and so great, as evidenced by the Pyramid of the Sun and the Pyramid of the Moon outside of Mexico City. Have you ever thought about that? How did people cut off in the Western world, in North and South America, who came over here, they tell us, from a land bridge? And, you know, most of those people are Oriental, aren't they? Mongols? Take a look at the American Indians in the West. Take a look at their eyes. You can tell that they came from Siberia. Then take a look at the Eastern Indians. Take a look at the Aztecs and the Mayans and the cultures of South America. Take a look at those people. Those people aren't Mongoloid. Then take a look at the Mayan and the Aztec pyramids. Those pyramids are carbon copies of the pyramids of Egypt. Now, did they build those pyramids over here, totally cut off from the Egyptians, without any knowledge of Egypt or having never seen those pyramids? And they built carbon copies of them. And furthermore, it was the Israelites that built those pyramids during the period that they were slaves in Egypt. It was the Israelites who built the pyramids of Egypt, and it was the Israelites who built the Pyramid of the Sun and the Pyramid of the Moon in Mexico. And more than likely, built the pyramids of the Mayans and the Aztecs and the Incas of South America. And if they didn't build them, they certainly had a very strong influence on them, because they're carbon copies of the same pyramids and the same structures, these same pagan structures that came out of Assyria and Babylon and Egypt, from our Israelite forefathers, who also were pagans. They did not follow the God of Abraham. They followed the gods of the Babylonians and the Egyptians. And you'll see that in America, B.C., and in plain sight. Well, we're about out of time. I got to give you a final reminder. We'll take this up right here on page 160. We're looking at the Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, the Israelites' Rise to Greatness, the first British and American empire, about 1000 B.C., when we come back next time. Now, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Remember, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and good night, friends.